Well, you're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. Yesterday's city and school board elections yielded some incumbents returning to their posts and some surprises. Mayor Bob Scott won a decisive victory over challenger Maria Rehnquist, and voters delivered a split decision on the five-member council. Scott is a businessman. He earned 68% of the vote, and he is here today with Siouxland Public Media, Sheila Brummer.
Well, Mayor Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're going to serve a fifth term after the election yesterday.
Yes.
A fifth term, and that would make you, if you...
It would be a sixth term.
It's your sixth term coming
right.
up. Wow.
Yeah.
So you would be the longest serving mayor coming up.
I'm already the longest serving mayor, I guess, but if I make it through this term, I would be the longest serving council member as well.
Wow. Well, congratulations
on
the election.
Any
surprises about some of the other elections that took place? We, of course, had the city council race with Rhonda Capron and Julie Shaner.
Well, you know, Rhonda did pretty well in the primary, and then Julie obviously won yesterday. And that's kind of the history in Sioux City. If you track elections, it's easier for the challenger to gain traction in the general election than it is for the incumbent. You know, we're going to have a new council member, and the rest of us will adjust to that, I'm sure. We'll miss Rhonda. She's been a great supporter of the council. So it'll be a little time to get to know Julie better. I don't think any of us know her very well. I know I don't, but looking forward to working with her.
And we'll hear from both Rhonda and Julie. We talked to them last night as well after the election results. And also with school board, too, it looked like, I know Mayuki Nelson was appointed to the board, but it looked like you were the only true incumbent who retained their office.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky.
do you think that that's a sign that people maybe, they like change, they want things to...
Well, I think Sioux City has a history of that.
That's what you just said, yeah.
Yeah, I think Sioux City has a real history of not being kind to incumbents. So I think that's... was evident again last night, because in the school board election, I thought they were all great candidates, and I didn't think anybody really distinguished themselves in the different debates that I watched and that. So it's just maybe Sioux City, that's the way we do things. So.
Well, and I talked to Rhonda last night. She says politics has changed over the years. Have you noticed that? I know with social media, people are more active. If they don't like something that you do, like a decision you make, they'll let you know about it.
Right. Yeah, and the other thing is, so I think from my vantage point, probably because I've gotten older and a little more mature maybe, and not as goofy as I was back in the 90s, I've actually found people to be on the street to be a lot more friendly and come up and tell you if you're doing a good job and that. But certainly on social media, not everyone's kind to you, but you have to accept that. That's just the world we live in today.
And you think that's probably part of the job?
Well, of course. I mean, you better be open for criticism or you shouldn't seek one of these offices. I don't think any of us have all the answers. So sometimes the way that people would tell you that you're doing a bad job, I'm not sure is the proper way. But to let us know that they don't agree with our decisions, I don't have a problem with that.
All right. And when it comes to decisions, what do you have planned for the future of Sioux City?
Well, I said when I ran, there's some things I want to work on. I've always worked on economic development, and I want to continue to do that. And in that includes housing. We need to continue to address housing because of the labor shortage in this community. I want to continue to work on getting these streets fixed up. We've spent a lot of money this year, and hopefully we'll spend a lot of money in the next. I've asked the staff to give us a 4 or 5 year timetable of how we could do a lot of these streets and get some of these potholes fixed with asphalt overlays. And lastly, I want to make sure we continue to invest in parks, especially that riverfront park. You might have even been around when I got off the last time. If you remember, we had a plan to do the riverfront. Nothing got done. That's just not acceptable. We need to get that riverfront moving at least so that if we start, hopefully they'll finish at that point. So,
what about downtown Sioux City? I know when you drive through, there are many empty buildings. What do you do about that situation?
There aren't as many as you think right now. Some of the smaller ones, but the Hatch furniture is going to be redone. We've got a developer on that. The Badger building will be redone. We have a lot of interest in that particular building. Warriors being done. Davidson's being done. Commerce building's being done. So there aren't a lot of buildings other than small ones. You know, the Benson building is a prime target, and I know there's people looking at that. So we're actually running out of inventory in older buildings downtown of any size and significance. The other problem is we don't have any green land down there, like a bare land, like all you see in other communities. We have developers that would develop in downtown Sioux City, but we don't have the land available to them right now. unfortunate because some of the projects would be kind of exciting if we could find some.
And you're a lifelong Sioux Cityan. What do you like about Sioux City? You obviously, I would think that you love being here, but what is it about Sioux City that has you saying, hey, I want to be mayor of this community?
Well, first of all, this community has been really good to my family and I. We've done very well here. I'm not sure we'd have done this well in any other community. Secondly, the citizens of this community are really good to serve. You know, when we have a project, they come together and we get a project done, unlike a lot of communities. So it's just a great place to serve. You know, not every day being mayor is a good day, but I would tell you there are more good days than bad days by far in this job. And I enjoy it just because I like to try to help people, and I just enjoy the interaction with the public.
And it's a job that really doesn't pay well. And if you're on school board, that doesn't pay at all. So yeah, well, why be a politician?
Well, in the first place, I served on the school board, and I admire the heck out of those people because you get nothing but sometimes aggravation. At least we get some health insurance and a small paycheck that at least covers your expenses. And really, if you're serving for money, then you shouldn't serve a local government no matter what. You ought to move on to a higher office.
All right, Mayor Scott, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah,
thank you.
I appreciate you stopping by today, and congratulations once again.
All right,
thank you. That's Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott talking about his win last night as mayor of Sioux City. Mary?
Yeah, and I believe you spoke to both of the candidates for city council last night as well.
Yeah, Julie Shaner, she beat incumbent council member Rhonda Capron. That vote was pretty close. It was within 400 votes. It was 51% to 48%. And we actually caught up with Julie Shaner. She had a gathering. She owns Soho on Historic 4th, and we talked to her after the election.
It was neck and neck, and I was trying not to even watch those numbers, honestly. And when we pulled ahead, it was just sheer excitement. I couldn't be more thankful.
And now you'll be a new member of the Sioux City City Council. What will be some of your top priorities when you first get in on the council?
Well, I will be sworn in right around the exact time that the new CIP is going to be developed, so that will be a priority. The first several months learning about the CIP, more about our budget, planning that, and then I'll be ready to get right on board with some of the hot topics around Sioux City, which are the infrastructure plan, affordable housing, those kinds of things. I've got some good ideas for that, along with some creative ideas for that riverfront that we're going to be starting soon.
And what are some of those creative ideas?
Well, the creative ideas for the riverfront is I'd like to see a little retail offered. We did have a post online of an idea that I had about reusing some shipping containers and maybe making some micro little businesses down there. I'd also like to give people the opportunity to start their small business there. That would be a great way for the city to support some family-owned businesses. Other ideas are coming up with the 10-year plan for the infrastructure rather than the shorter-term plans that we have to really see what we're up against, because I don't think that we've ever looked at the entire picture. So I'd like to see the city broken down into a grid and then take a look at the entire picture. How old is this infrastructure? Is it actually functioning? Where should we start? Kind of create a triage on how we fix it, put a price tag on that, and then we go to work to figure out how will we pay for it.
What do you think put you over the top? I mean, it was such a close race.
I think it was a very close race. I think in the beginning the absentee ballot seemed to go my opponent's way. And I think the absentee ballots are our longer-term Sioux Cityans that have lived here longer, maybe a little more senior. And I think that I related with the everyday people, the small business owners, just people ready for a little change.
And I think that was kind of the theme, at least what we saw at the school board level as well.
Yes, I agree. I think the school board also was key to this because I think that is kind of a little bit of a heated, you know, race there. So I think that brought more people out as well.
All right. Anything else you'd like to add or anything else you'd like to say?
I want to say thank you so much for everyone who voted for me, for your support, for trusting me, because it takes trust to vote for someone who you want to represent you. And that means a lot to me. And I'm going to go to work. I'm going to do the best I can. Thank you.
And Rhonda Capron spent the evening watching the election results at the Woodbury County Courthouse, and the early returns, including the absentee ballots, had put her in the lead. That changed as more precincts reported later on in the evening, and she also talked to us shortly after finding out the final numbers.
Well, I tell you, I feel good about the election, actually. You know, I ran a good race. It was all on the up and up. It was positive, and that's who I am. So with that said, I don't feel like I have anything to regret. I just know that Sioux City is going to be taken care of. We have a good council, and they have integrity, and I hope that things work out for the whole council and for the city.
Is there anything you would want to say to your challenger, to Julie, at all?
I wish her luck.
Do you think you'll plan to run again in the future, or?
Absolutely not. I'm done. You know, things have changed over the last few years, and you know, I go high. I want to be positive, and politics have changed, and I don't like the way they're going. And that's why I want to be on council, because I am positive, and I want to see the city move forward, and I want to see good things happen. So with that said, I'm done.
And that's Sioux City Council member Rhonda Capron, who lost in the election against business owner Julie Shaner. The final vote again, 51-48%. You can hear, of course, the sadness in her voice after hearing those results last night. Rhonda's been serving two terms. She's been in since 2012, and she is a very active council member. You see her out and about at many different meetings. She actually puts the work into it. So I know, Rhonda, for her, that was a defeat that she does take to heart. And you heard that she does not plan to run again. And then Julie Shaner says she's ready to go when she hits the ground running in January. Mary?
And we do have some numbers on how many people actually voted.
Yeah, the vote, usually this is kind of the first time that they've done the city council and city elections together. And we have, it's like 57,000 people in the whole county who are registered to vote. And the people who voted this time around, Pat Gill, who is the election commissioner, and he's also the auditor, he said, you know, historically, you know, you might have maybe 10-15% of people vote in this type of election. Of course, this is the first of its type, but they had 26% people of the registered voters show. And he was, you know, he said, wow, this is really, really good turnout. Of course, you still had, you know, 74% of people who didn't vote who were registered, but Pat Gill says he was very pleased with this as well. He said the big thing, too, absentee ballots. They had 5,000 people in the county return those, and he says that's the highest that they've ever seen. He also did something new, too. They send out mailers now to alert registered voters and people in Sioux City that, hey, you know, there's a chance to vote for absentee ballots, and also give them more awareness where they need to go vote, what precinct, where they can find that information as well, Mary.
There's a lot of turnover on the school board. In fact, the only incumbent failed to win.
Yeah, and Mayuki Nelson was appointed to that role after Mike Kreisel had resigned from his post. And she actually, the early returns, absentee ballots came in, and they showed her behind in the race. And it looked like, you know, more people, and this is what I've heard from people who were there, some political insiders who said, you know, it looks like people wanted change. They wanted four new fresh faces on that board. Dan Greenwell is a big vocal person. He goes to city council, he goes to those different school board meetings, and he came out at top with 22%. But then if you look at the rest of the field, it was so close, Mary. I mean, you had Western Iowa Tech's Julie Albert. She had 17%. Dan Greenwell had that 22%. But then you look at Monique Scarlett, she had 15%, just about 4,500 votes. And then Taylor Goodwin, he had 4,300, over 4,300 votes. It was so close. And then Mayuki, she was only 300 votes behind at 14%. So it was super close. And Sean Broyhill, too, also had 14%. So you had people really vocal, people were voting. And I think the big thing, too, is there was awareness. You saw these candidates out and about. Many different forums took place. You had a forum that you hosted and moderated. So I think people had a good look at who the candidates were, and they were invested in the races. I think that's what you saw here with that 26% turnout.
And so the people that were elected, it was Monique Scarlett, Dan Greenwell, Taylor Goodwin, who was not at the forum, and then Julian Albert. And so we do have some outtakes from that forum. Here's Monique Scarlett.
I believe that one of our biggest strengths of the Sioux City Community School District is basically within the mission statement alone. We have to believe, achieve, and succeed. I bring that community collaboration. I think that has always been welcoming among our school district for outside organizations or citizens to bring in that input, ideas, and implementation that can go forth with that. So I believe that is one of the biggest strengths, in my opinion. One of the weaknesses, in the same manner, is also taking those ideas, every idea, every thought, every conversation seriously, and doing necessary investigation or necessary research to bring about a better sound answer for our community students and teachers. So I believe that is something that we can definitely continue to improve on.
And that's Monique Scarlett. And now we're going to hear from Dan Greenwell.
Well, I have a passion for public education, and although I'm Catholic, my children are baptized Catholic, we chose to enroll them in the public schools to get a broad education, a good education with the people that are going to live with their life, and we think the public schools offers that opportunity. I think the course offerings are very good for our students. They can grow in any area that they want. They have an option to take things that interest them mostly. I think the areas where we can improve on, and I've been a fairly vocal community member on the financial side of things. I think we do a very poor job of budgeting. There's areas that need to be strengthened. The other area is an openness, a culture of openness and transparency. You know, that sounds like a hollow phrase, but quite frankly, I've been calling for transparency for a number of years at the school board on a number numerous topics, student achievement, the strategic plan, things like that. So I think that's an area that we can improve, and hopefully with my professional background and expertise, we can do that.
And finally, Julene Albert, she is a vice president of learning for Western Iowa Tech Community College, and she's been employed in education for 27 years, and here are some of what she sees as the strengths and weaknesses of the district.
But I think our greatest strength is our teachers. They give of themselves tirelessly. They work long hours. They spend their own money. They work a job that is often a very thankless job, and we have some of the best, if not the best, teachers in the state. And one of our challenges, of course, is going to be to continue to attract good talent to this part of the state, because we have to have the finances and the support in order to be able to continue to do that. But I want to point out another strength, and that is all of our new facilities are really quite amazing. I just coincidentally read an article this morning about a district that has buildings that are full of asbestos and full of mold, and the students are having a lot of health issues. And you know, I think that the district's done a lot within the last few years to try to remediate that issue. Clearly a challenge in this community right now is there is a struggle with a climate of trust between the board, the community, the parents, the teachers, and budgeting is part of that. I have a sense that there is more to it than just simply the budget. That's something that we need to get to the bottom of and try to rebuild that feeling of trust, because our students ultimately are hurt.
And that's Julene Albert, a new member of the school board. She works here at Western Iowa Tech. Well, Sheila, now the election is finally over. Everyone will just start looking towards 2020 now in the caucuses.
Yeah, that gets started. And, of course, we'll be covering it extensively. So many different candidates still on the Democratic side. So that'll be an interesting race coming up. And recent polls, of course, showed that Pete Buttigieg has moved up quite a bit. Elizabeth Warren still has momentum. Former Vice President Joe Biden, of course, faltering in some of those most recent polls. So it'll be interesting to see how that race shapes up as we head into the tail end of the caucus season.
All right. Thank you, Sheila. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay. Bye-bye. And you're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, it's almost Veterans Day. It's coming up on Monday. There'll be observances by the city at the Woodbury County Courthouse and also out here at Western Iowa Tech Community College. A new book of photography from World War II is coming out in time for the day. It's called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. It was put together by Mark Jacob and Richard Cahan. The authors scoured the National Archives and reached out to families of veterans and also talked to some vets from World War II still living. They found some amazing and sometimes disturbing photographs that reveal some of the lesser seen experiences of war. I talk with Mark Jacob about how they chose 1945 for a focus of the book. Jacob said a lot of the terrible atrocities of the war became public that year.
1945 was a year when the whole world understood what had happened in the death camps and the concentration camps and the ruination. You know, some of the pictures in the book, some of the most amazing and beautiful pictures in the book show ruined cities in Japan, in Germany, and from the bombings and from the warfare that took place. And it wasn't until, you know, the Allies rolled in and were conquering territory that they realized, you know, that they could had the full assessment of all the wreckage.
What strikes me is that few of these photographers were professionals. Is that right?
Yes, some were like staff photographers for newspapers and things, but the vast majority of the soldier photographers who were in the U.S. Signal Corps who took these pictures were amateurs. They were, I mean, one guy who took a really excellent photo that's in the book was a clerk at a camera store in San Antonio, Texas, for example. But some of them had no particular photo experience, and as they joined the military or were drafted and chose this line of service, they were trained both in movie cameras and in still cameras, and then kind of chose which way they went, and so they were trained. But and after the war, some of them went on to, you know, to remain photographers. One of the photographers won a Pulitzer Prize in Boston years later.
These photographers saw some pretty terrible things. Did they suffer from that later on? Because I remember watching a documentary about people, photographers, both still photographers and videographers, who they went to some of the concentration camps after the war and dealt with that, and they said that it was just terrible and they never could get it out of their mind.
That's worth understanding is that these photographers saw horrible things very often. I mean, the regular GIs saw combat for, you know, a few days, and then they would be, you know, would not see action for, you know, months at a time. So the horror and the trauma they suffered was less frequent and less continual than these photographers. So yes, they were affected greatly by it. We talked to some of the families of some of them, and, you know, for example, the guy on our cover is a guy named Jack Pulliam, who was we talked to his family. He was traumatized because he was a POW. He was captured in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was taken prisoner. He was held prisoner for about a month. He escaped, and then as he was trying to make his way back to the Allied lines, he was hiding in a house, and a German officer came in, and he had to kill the German officer to stay safe. The picture shows him coming back to the Allied lines, and he's wearing the German officer's cap, the one he killed, and he has this like 1,000-yard stare on his face, like he has seen so much. We thought it was the perfect cover photo because the book is called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, and here is this guy who has clearly been through this experience that he's going to live with the rest of his life. His family shared a 20-page memoir that he had written of his time being captured and escaping.
It seems like it must have been extremely dangerous at times, even if you're just serving as a journalist, a photographer. I mean, today we see that journalists get killed quite often.
Right. We don't have an exact, you know, death toll, but we believe, you know, a few dozen may have been killed. There's one documented case that's in the book of one photographer recalling seeing a comrade, another photographer, dead in an Italian street after a German plane had strafed the area. So, it was dangerous. And the thing about it is they were armed with sidearms, but they couldn't carry a camera and a gun at the same time. So very often the gun was holstered and they were taking pictures. So, it was dangerous duty. They had Eisenhower in Europe gave the these photographers what they called a blue pass, which allowed them to travel anywhere and go kind of go where the action was. But going where the action was meant that they put themselves in danger. Yeah, it was not safe duty for sure.
I know that some of the journalists and photographers who covered D-Day had they managed to come down behind enemy lines dropping out of a plane, and they were sending, for instance, messages via carrier pigeon out of there covering D-Day. And they were just walking around right within distance of all of these German troops. So it amazes me how anyone comes out of that, but, you know, you can't predict.
No, you can't. No, I think that we have a lot of quotes from these photographers in the book, and they had no idea what they were going to encounter. I mean, just think of how unimaginable it would have been to roll in with U.S. troops into a death camp, into a camp where human beings had been slaughtered in factory manner for months and months. I mean, it's the experience. There's an amazing picture in the book that I had not seen before that shows Dachau after the American troops took it over, and they were so appalled by what they saw that they gathered up the SS guards and lined them up, and some of them were shot. I mean, it was investigated as a war crime, but nothing came of it because obviously the U.S. was the winning side. But that was the kind of image that you didn't really see during that time. So we looked for pictures that were not your typical World War II picture that everyone had seen. We looked for a kind of unusual shots. These photographers also, it should be remembered, Mary, that these people, part of their duty was to produce photos for propaganda purposes. So the military was very careful about what they let out during the war and the immediate aftermath. So some of the pictures were censored. For example, during the American occupation of Japan after the war, the military censors would not let pictures be shown of GIs with Japanese women because they thought that would be bad for morale on the home front.
How did you get access to some of these lesser-known and lesser-seen photos?
Well, they're all in the National Archives. The National Archives is this wonderful resource, and the people there are terrific. And all the pictures are cataloged and there for anyone to look at, but there are so many of them, hundreds of thousands of them. So it's just a matter of going through and, editing them and finding and just really looking for things that were not typical. And we tried to find a variety of pictures that just kind of spoke to kind of the aftermath of war and the last days of war. For example, one of my pictures I really like to show is back in England, and an Englishman who is missing one of his legs is riding a bicycle in front of a bunch of GIs who are in wheelchairs, and all of those GIs are missing a limb, and so he's demonstrating how to ride a bike for them. So all the photos are not on the front lines, but they all reflect what war meant. And I think part of the aim of the book was to just kind of to show this is the last total war we've been in. This was total war. What you'll see in the book is a lot of civilians were killed, and were just this war was a war that targeted civilians as much as people in uniform, and I think today we have this situation where America is in the midst of its longest war. The longest war in history is going on right now, yet America isn't in a war footing or a war mentality. The war in Afghanistan seems quite distant. And as we were going through these pictures, we kind of had this realization that Americans don't really understand what war is and how terrible and all-consuming war can become. It's become kind of made into a kind of a distant, vague thing for so much of our society.
I remember when I watched The Sorrow and the Pity, and they showed such graphic images of how collaborators were treated in France after the war, and seeing some other images that have come out, in the last 20 years or so of the war. What kind of effect do you think that has on people to see really the reality of the war versus kind of the war all of us were shown, or the people that were alive then were shown and were told it was about and how people behaved. There is definitely a difference.
Yes, I mean, one of our goals was to really give people reality. I mean, the book is has some very shocking images, you know, of kind of war crimes and Nazi atrocities, for example, and Japanese atrocities. But it's, I mean, the odd thing about it is that it's a beautiful book because we took all the negatives, rescanned them, so the pictures look more alive and vibrant and robust than ever before. And, you know, with new kind of new scanning technology, the photos look great. And they're beautiful. But at the same time, they're ugly because they show, I mean, the ugliness of man. And I think that, for example, one of the pictures we have in the book shows a dead horse along a roadside in Germany. And the villagers are leaning over the horse, taking pieces of the horse to eat because there's so much starvation in Germany after the war, and and so this is not the kind of picture that the U.S. or anyone else would have shown, you know, at that time. Yeah, but yet, that was the reality that people were facing. And I think that one of the things that the takeaway from this book is just that wars are uncontrollable, and they don't just affect people with guns in their hands; they affect everyone.
I mean, surprisingly to me, not all of these photographers were professionals.
Plus, they were in a big hurry because they were moving all the time with advancing armies. So the captions on the back of the pictures were not great. So a lot of times we had to do investigative work to figure out what was actually in a picture and what it meant, and they also made mistakes we had to correct and things like that. So what we ended up doing is just following up the pictures and learning stories about the pictures. So I think the captions or the text blocks that go next to the pictures are very instructive, and you'll learn really interesting stories about these brave combat photographers and the people they photographed.
That was Mark Jacob, who, along with co-author Richard Cahan, created the book Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. The book shows some little scene photographs of some of the tough situations and frightening situations of World War II in 1945. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial, LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at www.legacyfinancialllc.com. Securities offered through United Planners Financial Services member FINRA and SIPC, and financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. Well, Veterans Day is Monday, a day to honor people who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, originally known as Armistice Day, to mark the official end of World War I on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Bob Protexter of Sioux City wrote a special tribute for his father who served during World War II. Here's This Is My Father's Flag.
This is my father's flag of Donald Homer Protexter. This is my father's flag in memoriam of his dedicated and diligent service to the United States of America. I have to write this because I knew he never would. This is my father's flag that is located in the row of flags in the front row of Graceland Park Cemetery, that is located on Lakeport Avenue in the neighborhood of Morningside, that is located in Sioux City, Iowa, that is located in the United States of America. This is my father's flag donated by our family in recognition of his service to our country in World War II. Some call it the Second World War. Some call it the Great Patriotic War. The First World War was the war to end all wars, but of course this was not the case. So there is a World War II. This is my father's flag for time spent and time wagered in the 1940s in parts far away in Egypt, in Italy, in France, and in many more parts unknown in towns and fields and places and mountains and valleys and more places and more places and more places that would even be difficult to locate on the best of maps. This is my father's flag for time allowed to write letters home to his mother.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But
for time not allowed for sleep. For two packs of lucky strikes won in a game of cards where the winners smoked and the losers played again so that they could smoke. For drinking coffee out of a tin mug. For wearing the color of military green for years at a time, for wearing that same colored helmet for 24 hours at a time, and again for letters that were sent to home detailing the helmets, the green, the coffee, the cigarettes, and the sleep not allowed. This is my father's flag for driving wide ammunition trucks over thin bridges, obtaining scars that would never go away, and obtaining sights that would never be spoken about again. This is my father's flag for his service to his country as a serviceman in the 34th Infantry Division, also known as the Red Bull. This is my father's flag that is located at the intersection of Sunnybrook and Lakeport, directly by and closest to the signal light that is located some thousands of miles away from where many countrymen were laid to rest. And this is my father's flag located some mere feet from where he was laid to rest, with flag folded, with family emboldened, with widow molded. This is my father's flag.
Flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue.
Bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
After his military service, Donald Homer Protexter was best known as the head baseball coach at Morningside College in Sioux City, a post he held from 1955 until his untimely death in 1963 at the age of 60. His son Bob carries on his baseball legacy. Bob recently helped coach the Russian national baseball team in pre-Olympic qualifying here in 2019 and finished out the baseball year in September, serving as coach at the MLB All-Star Cadet Camp in Regensburg, Germany, for the top 50 prospects in Europe. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, we've been talking about next week. Veterans Day is on Monday, but also next Monday, the 10th annual Project Wahima Ministries Sing for Africa program is being held at the Bishop Heelan Fine Arts Building. The proceeds will go towards helping to find homes for Tanzanian orphans. Kelly Solzma is one of the founders of the project. She told me how that project began.
I've been involved in mission work in Tanzania, East Africa, for 22 years now. I was with a different nonprofit for 10 years, and then just had that nudge, that feeling that I really wanted to focus in and hone in on the orphans of Tanzania. And that's when Project Rahima was formed in 2007 and named after a little girl named Rahima Ntandu, who passed away when she was only 7 or 8 years old from HIV. And her name in Swahili means compassion. And that's what our project is all about.
And so basically, you're trying to find real homes for these kids.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I hesitate to even call it a, quote, orphanage, because that's the last thing we want to be seen as, versus having small homes with a mama and a handful of orphans, to where it's like a real family setting. Like, for example, you could walk by one of our many Rahima homes and not even know that orphans live there. We don't put big signs out in front because, you know, nobody wants to be known as an orphan. And especially over there, sometimes they're ostracized because of that. So we want them to just blend in with their environment and be contributing members of their environment and their communities versus being in a, quote, institution.
Yeah, because I imagine being in an institution, especially if you've already been through trauma, must be very, very damaging for kids.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Because the stories of these kids is just, it's unfathomable. Some of the things that these kids have been through, and yet they carry on with a smile on their face. So they're my inspiration. They truly are. We go there thinking we can help them, and we do, but it's such a beautiful exchange because I know for me, they've taught me just how precious life is and what a strong faith is. So they it's a beautiful exchange.
This concert, which is coming up, it's an opportunity to help the kids, help find homes, and to hear some really great music.
It's just a fun night where you can, it's our 10th annual too. We've been doing the concert for 10 years now, but it's just a fun night where you can come. You don't have to do anything. You just sit down, kick back, and relax. And it's an event showcasing some of the amazing talent we have right here in Siouxland.
And this is going to be at Bishop Heelan in the new space they have there.
In their new fine arts building. And some of the performers will be four different choirs: Celebration Choir, Mount Zion, Bishop Heelan Chorale, St. John Choir, and then Jill Miller, Kevin Keane, Kami Brown, the Tadpoles, which is a percussion group from Heelan. So it's just a nice mix of different performers and showcasing some of the amazing people we have right here in Siouxland.
How can people find out more about this?
You can go to our website at www.projectrahima.org, and Rahima is R-E-H-E-M-A, or they can always give me a call, shoot me an email, and you can still buy tickets at the door too. I've had a lot of people ask that too, if they have to get the tickets ahead of time. And no, they do not. But it is. It's a fun evening, all for a good cause.
You know how fortunate most kids are in this country, and sometimes it's hard for them to understand, you know, that sometimes kids go through a lot.
Oh, absolutely, because last year, I was able to take a group of kids from Morningside College. They were a group of football players, and one of them was my son. And, you know, as much as he's heard about it for the last 22 years, to actually be immersed in that and just see what it's really like there.
Kelly Solzma is the president of Project Rahima Ministries. Kelly, along with the project board of directors, will be presenting the 10th annual Sing for Africa concert, and that's next Monday night, November the 11th, in the Bishop Heelan Fine Arts Building. And a special convocation at Western Iowa Tech Community College earlier this week, actually yesterday, Tuesday, united students, staff, and members of the community. The event, hosted by the International Honor Society, Phi Theta Kappa, focused on global issues concerning agriculture. Sealand Public Media, Sheila Brummer served as MC for the event and brings us the sounds and messages from experts and entertainers.
The depth of five voices serenades a group of more than 100 at the Rockland Center on the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College on Tuesday. A high-energy performance representing four different tribes from Tanzania. Ando is the spokesperson for the New Life Band.
We're so glad we're here in this event, and he'll be speaking and we'll be sharing our African culture, music. Yeah.
The international guests also teach some in the crowd the art of African dancing.
You move your hands and your head at the same time. Are you ready? Here we go.
But what started as a lighthearted event took a more serious turn when Dr. Steve Meyer took the stage.
I got a lot of stuff to say, and I think it all kind of fits together, I hope.
The orthopedic surgeon founded the Siouxland Tanzania Educational Ministries, also known as STEM, more than 22 years ago. He says agriculture is essential for the East African nation, where farmers still use more primitive ways to plant their crops.
70% is still raised with a hoe, 20% by oxen, and 10% by tractor. There was a study done by the World Health Organization a while back that showed that if they would get every farmer a garden tiller, they would increase production by 400%. If you think about this, it's mind-boggling to me. In a country where they currently have 4G and soon to be 5G networks, and everyone has a cell phone and...
Meyer says the average yield for corn is 25 bushels, compared to a number 10 times higher or more in Iowa. Plus, a majority of people living in rural areas survive on less than $1.50 a day.
In sub-Saharan Africa, 40% of school-aged children are permanently intellectually stunted, which means that they can't learn, they can't grow, they can't produce, they can't contribute to their economy because of lack of proper micronutrients and nutrition in their diet in the first 5 years. And lack of proper nutrition is responsible in Tanzania and worldwide for one half of all deaths in the country under age five.
Dr. Meyer also says something needs to be done to prevent the death of children worldwide, where one every 10 seconds dies of starvation.
And I hope that this problem can be solved. I have faith in the people of America and our ingenuity, and I certainly believe that we have to love the people of the world outside of our own geography, our own skin color, our own culture and creed.
We are successful because of profits. So a lot
when it comes to the financial outlook for farmers closer to home, Gary Wright, a farm management specialist with ISU Extension and Outreach, shared his insight on agriculture in the U.S. and the impact of the trade war with China and the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA.
My understanding is we're so busy with what's going on in Washington right now that it's not going anywhere, and we need to have that agreement signed. We need to have it officially stamped for approval in America.
U.S. trade with China has been a growing problem for a number of years.
And finally, former state lawmaker and government relations special projects coordinator at Western Iowa Tech, Steve Wornstadt, shared a detailed economic perspective. Wornstadt says Iowa lost $1.1 billion in exports from 2017 to 2018, and another country picked up the business with environmental consequences.
Again, I'm not going to say that this is 100% causation, but it is a contributing factor. What happened in Brazil this summer? Remember the fires? A lot of those fires were started in part because they wanted to expand ag production. Expand ag production for what? Well, now there's this huge market in soybeans, so let's burn forest land to set up farmland in Brazil in order to grow more soybeans to produce to China. It is a small world after all, right?
I mean, when you're talking about these things, awareness, it shows how of the how impact of agriculture in the heartland and beyond. In Sioux City, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
The New Life Band arrived in Sioux City in the middle of October with the support of Morningside Lutheran Church. They recently took part in a fundraising event for STEM. Dr. Steve Meyer of STEM told the crowd about the horrific school bus crash in Tanzania back in 2017, where only three lived and three dozen died. Three missionaries from STEM helped save the lives of those young survivors who spent months in Sioux City receiving medical treatment for their wounds. Dr. Meyer called the situation a medical miracle and says the three survivors are thriving today. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and Mayor Bob Scott also for coming in and talking with us the day after the election. You're listening to Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.